This is CME on ReachMD. The following activity titled, Expert Answers to Common Questions for Optimizing First-Line Treatment Selection in Advanced Ovarian Cancer, is provided by Axis Medical Education and is supported by an educational grant from Genentech. Prior to beginning the activity, please review the faculty and commercial support disclosure statements as well as the learning objectives.
Hello and welcome to this educational activity entitled Expert Answers to Common Questions for Optimizing First-Line Treatment Selection in Advanced Ovarian Cancer. My name is Brad Monk. I'm a gynecologic oncologist and professor here in Phoenix within the Division of Gynecologic Oncology, both at the University of Arizona and Creighton Universities. I'm also a member of the U.S. Oncology Network and practice here in Arizona Oncology. This activity today will provide my expert perspective. I use that term loosely as an expert, but I'm going to do my very best. And what I have done is I've acquired some participant questions from a recent series of Access-sponsored grand rounds that were focusing on newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer. Here is a disclaimer and disclosure indicating that we may be discussing off-label uses of approved agents or agents that are in development. And here are my financial disclosure information. Here are the learning objectives for today's event. Upon completion of this activity, I would hope that you would be better able to assess data about recent clinical trials and guideline recommendations, incorporating anti-angiogenesis agents and novel therapies such as PARP inhibitors into the first-line treatment of patients with advanced ovarian cancer. And I would hope that you could apply these evidence-based clinical data and guidelines so that patients could benefit from these anti-angiogenesis agents, ideally in specific patient populations, really to maximize therapeutic opportunities. So these are the questions that were asked to the participants, and they were very interested in certainly side effects and diagnoses, but there was a lot of what I call other, and that included systemic therapy, although 12% wanted some general treatment and 8% some surgical guidelines. I think I can put that together, that 20% right now, into a statement that about 50% of newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer patients are treated with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, with the surgery integrated between the third and the fourth cycle. The decision to do that is very complicated. It's based on physical examination, the fitness of the patient, the findings radiologically, and sometimes even on laparoscopic assessment. But the rest of the questions were about systemic therapy, and that's what I'm going to focus on. And I want to focus on bevacizumab because bevacizumab was FDA approved in the frontline treatment of advanced ovarian cancer on December 13th, 2018. I also want to focus on olaparib because olaparib was FDA approved in BRCA mutated patients on December 19th, 2018. So within 2018, we had two frontline FDA approvals, unprecedented. And in fact, it's something new since the last approval of paclitaxel almost two decades ago. So I'm very enthusiastic about this. And then I'd like to discuss the upcoming trials because this is a rapidly evolving field. These four studies, one VELIA, which is a GOG study 3005, we added veliparib this time to chemotherapy and then included it in maintenance. It's also a PARP inhibitor. And then PRIMA, which is also frontline maintenance, but the idea is to expand it beyond BRCA, perhaps in a biomarker-identified patient such as homologous recombination deficiency patients or maybe even all comers. And then the BOOST trial, which is increasing the duration of bevacizumab from the current FDA-approved indication of 15 months, doubling it to 30, and then what really all of us are interested in, the combination. Maybe we should add a PARP inhibitor and bevacizumab together. So PALA-1 takes the GOG 218 indication, and then in the maintenance phase, adds olaparib. This is a very interesting study because the first two PARP inhibitor trials, VELIA and PRIMA, are biomarker-driven. That is the HRD or LOH high subgroup. BOOST is angiogenesis. We haven't really identified a biomarker, but PALA-1 tends more towards the angiogenesis side of things and is not a biomarker-driven primary endpoint. So let's talk about the best candidate here of newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer. Who would be the best candidate for bevacizumab? So in this table, I outline the June 13th, 2018 indication. And the label is in combination with carboplatin paclitaxel, followed by bevacizumab as a single agent for stage 3, 4 epithelial ovarian cancer, as well as a tubal and peritoneal after surgical resection. So that's a complex sentence. So the first is stromal tumors, sex cords tumors, germ cell tumors would not be eligible. Early stage patients would not be eligible. Histologic subtype, certainly ovarian, fallopian tube, and peritoneal, but not sarcomas. And following surgical resection. So this was according to our 2011 New England Journal paper. And you can see that there are two endpoints. The 10.3 versus 14.1 endpoint in the paper, and now 12.0 in the control arm, placebo arm, versus 18.2. And why is that? So in the paper, we used CA125 as an endpoint, but for the label, it's only radiologic resist. That's what the FDA wanted. That's what's in the label. The PFS got a little longer because CA125s go up earlier. 6.2 months improvement in progression-free survival and a hazard ratio of 0.62. And then on the right side of the table is the confirmatory trial. Again, it was half the dose of bevacizumab, 12 months rather than 15 months. Earlier stage patients were included, but it's a confirmatory trial and published in the same edition of the New England Journal. And the reference at the bottom of the slide, OZA Lancet Oncology, is an update. Incidentally, the update on GOG-218 is in press in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, and look for it within the month. So other than what the label states, tubal, epithelial ovarian, and peritoneal, 3 and 4, after surgery, what else can be used to select the ideal patient? Well, I already told you stage. We think that ascites basically is angiogenesis out of control. Those new blood vessels are fenestrated and leaky. As a new blood vessel forms, it's not completely tubularized. It leaks. Ascites is a biomarker in an initial subset analysis of 218 for a small benefit of PFS, but was not in the upcoming OS update. Ascites is difficult to measure, certainly in the Aurelia trial with weekly paclitaxel. Again, platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer, there's an improvement in patient-reported outcomes, presumably because there was a decrement in ascites. Biomarkers, again, have been shown to not really pan out on anti-angiogenic agents. Homologous recombination repair genetic signatures are prognostic, not predictive, meaning that patients who have BRCA mutations or BRCA-like mutations live longer, but that doesn't mean that they respond better to bevacizumab, but they do live longer because they respond better to DNA damaging agents such as platinum. Now, stage is appropriate for the label, all stage 3 and 4. But here in this slide, again, in press in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, there was an overall survival advantage in the stage 4 patients. I really need you to have this as a take-home message. When bevacizumab is added to stage 4 patients, they live 10 months longer compared to those that do not get bevacizumab. Said another way, that if you add bevacizumab to a stage 4 patient, she lives as long as a stage 3 patient. You negate the impact, the negative impact of stage when bevacizumab is added. And this is supported by ICON 7. So I get it that it was an unplanned analysis, but because the identical observation is in ICON 7, I think you can have some confidence. In ICON 7, in this what they call the high-risk subset, which is a lot of stage 4s, but also large volume residual disease patients. If you look at what they call the restricted mean, there was a 5-month improvement in overall survival. But if you look at the median here on the right-hand side of the slide, it's a 9-month, 9.4 months, which is pretty close to the 10-month GOG-218 improvement in overall survival associated with stage 4. So I think, based on these two trials, although not pre-specified, that we can be fairly confident that there's a 10-month improvement in overall survival in stage 4 patients. I already talked to you that ascites are good candidates, and the label is all stage 3 and 4 after surgery, but restricted the epithelial ovarian peritoneal and fallopian tube cancer. So this is a meta-analysis of these factors. It talks about the PFS benefit, that age, all ages benefit, that grade, really there's no difference, that performance status patients obviously do better, PS1 and 2 over 0. So as far as these mutations go, I showed you that with there's no BRCA-like or homologous recombination repair deficiency genes on the left, there's one outcome. You can see on the right that the curves are shifted to the right. These patients who have HRR gene mutations have a better PFS, but you can see that both slides show a benefit from bevacizumab. So that's what I mean when I say it's prognostic, meaning the HRR gene mutation groups do better, but it doesn't predict the increased efficacy of bevacizumab, and this is borne out also in the survival data that will come out in the Journal of Clinical Oncology any day. So next, let's transition and talk about olaparib, the June 19th, 2018 FDA approval. This was for maintenance. This was both for germline and somatic patients. Again, get treated with platinum taxane generally, epithelial ovarian cancer. And if you respond, whether you got neoadjuvant, primary debulking, even if you got bevacizumab, you can transition to maintenance olaparib. And it's both for germline and somatic. So you got to remember, it's not just testing the germline. You got to test the tumor. I would expect that the germline mutations would be somewhere around 17% or so, that the somatics would be about 7% or so. 17 plus 7 is 24%, which means about a quarter of patients can benefit from frontline maintenance olaparib. And again, that got FDA approved based on this SOLO-1 study, which I'm going to show you. And it's already recommended by the NCCN, and it's category 1 for the germline mutation subgroup, but 2A for the somatic mutation subgroup because there are only two somatics, but the biology suggests that the outcomes are the same, whether it's a germline BRCA 1 or 2 mutation or whether it's a BRCA 1 or 2 somatic mutation. And the NCCN guidelines have already been updated. They say, look, you got to make sure that after you complete treatment, again, of ovarian, tubal, or fallopian tube cancer, what their BRCA 1 or 2 genetic status is, okay? So don't delay the start of chemotherapy because it takes time, but make sure you get it done before it's time after their 6 cycles so that they can not miss the opportunity for olaparib. So again, don't delay, but get it done. Again, this is the germline testing guidelines, but we also recommend somatic testing. And this is the trial, 291 patients randomized if you respond to olaparib versus a placebo. You've seen this published in the New England Journal, presented last year at ESMO by our good friend and colleague, Katie Moore. This trial was also a GOG trial like GOG 218. And the endpoint is unprecedented. A hazard ratio of 0.30. An improvement of almost 3 years in progression-free survival from about 14 months at the median to about 50 months at the median in the olaparib group. And you can see the decay, the progressions in the non-olaparib patients. You'd think that these patients would do very well. They don't. But with olaparib, there might even be more cures. And in fact, at 3 years, there's a doubling of the progression-free survival from 26.9% to 60.4%. I don't know how you could deny a patient this opportunity. I talked to you about how to select bevacizumab for your patients, and we talked about some of the very important characteristics. I doubt that you would feel good about it or that the patient would feel good about it if you had a BRCA mutation and you didn't get maintenance olaparib. So I think this is the standard of care rather than a standard of care. And this is the subgroup analyses, and you can see that there is a important improvement in PFS in all the relevant subsets. And I call out here the stage threes and fours, as well as the patients who have clinical, partial, or complete responses. Again, unprecedented data. So I've shared with you these four studies. They differ in their populations. They differ in their designs, but they do not differ in the setting. Newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer. They do not differ in their primary endpoints, progression-free survival, and it is almost 3,000 patients that will report within the next year many of these probably at ESMO. So the time is evolving. In 2018, we got two FDA approvals for maintenance therapy, one in a biomarker a negative group, bevacizumab, and the other in a biomarker positive group, BRCA1 and 2 germline and somatic mutations. So what's the key takeaway? The key takeaway is molecular testing, personalized treatments, and maintenance. I don't think it's credible anymore to just do 6 doses of carboplatin and paclitaxel in newly diagnosed ovarian cancer and say, good luck. That's the best that we can do. It's not the best that we can do. We can add bevacizumab if you don't have a BRCA mutation, or we can have add a olaparib if you do. This creates wonderful opportunities, and we're going to try to expand the duration of bevacizumab in the BOOST trial and try to expand the opportunity for PARP inhibitors in both homologous recombination repair deficient patients, but maybe even all comers, and maybe all comers if you add both agents together. So I want to thank AXIS. I want to thank you for participating in this activity. If you hear my enthusiasm, it's real. The thing that I did not discuss in this Cliff Notes summary is the toxicities. Toxicities are important. I do not want you to forget to balance activity versus toxicity. So thank you very much. So long for now, and greetings from Phoenix, Arizona.
You've been listening to CME on ReachMD. This activity is sponsored by AXIS Medical Education and supported by an educational grant from Genentech. To receive your free CME credit or to download this activity, go to reachmd.com/axismeded. Thank you for listening.